In the current situation, there is the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty is not threatened. It is not the position of the military council or any aspect of the interim government to cancel the peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. It's not the position of several of the presidential contenders. So I don't think that the peace treaty itself is under any severe threat. We don't sense that in any case. On the other hand, there are changes in the Egyptians' foreign policy which do affect us. Symbolically, I think of you can't just ignore it. Two Iranian warships transited the Suez Canal for the first time since 1979 under the new Egyptian government. It's true the warships, to the best of our knowledge, were not carrying armaments, but nevertheless, it's something which hadn't happened before. Egypt has stated that it wants to change the nature of its relationship with Iran. And that's not something which we look on with great favor, but nevertheless, that's Egypt's business. And Egypt has not, for the time being, changed substantively its position regarding the patrolling of Gaza's southern border, but they have stated that they will. And this is of great concern to us because it's important to us that if Hamas is ruling Gaza, that there be limits on what kind of munitions can go into Gaza. We don't want TNT and rockets passing from the Sinai Peninsula into Gaza. We very much hope that the Egyptian government will maintain that level of control. So I think I'm giving you some sort of sense of where the Israeli approach and feeling about all this. And I think I've answered to a certain extent the initial query that I raised at the beginning of the talk. Now, I'd like to go on to two other topics which are related. I'd like to speak about what all this means regarding Iran and its pursuit of nuclear weapons. And finally, to come to, I think, the most current and maybe a really difficult question, what does all this mean for Israel-Palestinian peacemaking? In terms of Iran, when we look at the Middle East, and if we dehumanize it for a moment and just look at it as a chessboard, we see the Arab Spring, one of its effects, an unintended effect, if there are intended effects in this incredible pattern of events, is the strengthening of Iran's strategic situation, strengthening of Iran's position vis-a-vis the world and vis-a-vis the Middle East. Why? First of all, we see a change. I don't want to call it really a weakening, but we see a change in the Western arc of opposition to Iran, which were the countries which are primarily opposed to the export of the Shiite revolution throughout the Middle East. Egypt, which is now convulsed within itself. Saudi Arabia and Jordan, both of which are stable, but which are also have gone through some shaking during this period. So the countries which are opposed to the Iranian leadership principle are not as they were 5 months ago. That's number one. Number two, the price of oil has gone up. And the price of oil, the Iranian economy is essentially based at this time on the export of oil and natural gas. And the increase of the price of oil has essentially increased the Iranian national budget by a third. Now, that does a number of things. First of all, it goes a far way towards helping Iran overcome the international sanctions which have been put in place against it. That's number one. Number two, that money is going to the Iranian National Guard, Revolutionary Guard. Iran has moved from being an Islamic theocracy to an Islamic military dictatorship. The monies, the oil monies which are going into Iran, enable Iran to withstand the Arab Spring. In other words, we believe that they have the capacities to put down any kind of urban revolts which will be going on there. And therefore, they are net strengthened. Democratization throughout the region is not reaching Tehran or Isfahan because the regime is powerful and has more money and has all of the mechanisms of repression at its fingers which it needs in order to suppress it. Finally, from our perspective, all of these dramatic events have caused, frankly, a lack of focus. One can only read so many articles in the New York Times and in the Wall Street Journal and in Foreign Policy or on NPR in any 24-hour period. And if you've got Egypt and Bahrain and Libya, then you have less reporting about Iran. And we feel that the international community has lost some of its focus. About 8,000 centrifuges, which are spinning 24 hours a day in Iran, creating nuclear materials whose purpose is the creation of nuclear weapons. Our feeling is, and something which I believe I'm certain will come up in Prime Minister Netanyahu's conversation with President Obama this Friday, is that it's very important to get things back on track. It is essential to put in place very, very deep and robust economic sanctions if the international community wants Iran not to have nuclear-tipped intermediate-range missiles. There is no other way, failing large-scale use of military force, but this requires a focusing, and this requires seeing through the fog of events, understanding things as they are, and dealing with them in real time. Our relationship with the Palestinians. So our relationship was, frankly, quite troubled before the Arab Spring. We went through about a year and a half when we were not negotiating. There were all kinds of reasons for it. On the one hand, we had a right-wing government or a center-right government in Israel, which for the first time, a Likud prime minister declared several times informally the support of his government for the establishment of a Palestinian state. In theory, the Palestinian Authority is signed on the Oslo Accords. That means that they are in favor of a peace treaty or a two-state solution with Israel. We should have gotten there, or we should have been able to move there. But the negotiations did not move forward for all kinds of reasons. There were Palestinian preconditions that we were willing to meet initially, but we weren't willing to meet them further on. Then they had preconditions. That we said that if they have preconditions, we also have preconditions. They wanted us to stop all building in any settlement area over the 1967 border. We said, well, what about recognition of us as the nation state of the Jewish people? We didn't get very far. Right now, however, we're in a different place. The Palestinians, Fatah and Hamas, have signed a unity pact agreement. It was signed at the end of April in Cairo. We know a lot of the details of this agreement, but not everything. We know that it means that a new interim Palestinian government will be appointed May 20th by the Palestinian Authority or by some sort of joint council in which Hamas and Fatah are taking place, and that there will be Palestinian elections 1 year from now. Now, I think the movement of the Palestinians towards internal unity or towards a desire to reach to one united governance is a reflection of the Arab Spring, because it's our sense that the Palestinian street wants its leaders to come together and for the Palestinians not to be divided between one leader, one government in Gaza and another government in the West Bank, who are enemies or very, very angry at each other. And that we can understand the desire of the Palestinians for unity, but we also have to be able to live with this unity. In other words, if we are to make peace with them. And it is a very, very deep problem for us when there is a unity pact which does not require Hamas joining this government to accept the quartet conditions. The quartet conditions are the conditions of the EU partners in the United States who are guiding the peace process. It basically says the following. Hamas is not a partner for peace negotiations. It's not our position. It's the position of the United States and Europe. Unless they recognize Israel, renounce terror, and accept the legality and bindingness of the Israeli-Palestinian agreements thus far, which essentially the peace process. And this unity pact has taken place without that. Hamas has not changed its position. And so we now find, to speak frankly, we find ourselves in a very, very difficult spot in terms of how to move forward. In other words, let's say we would continue the negotiations as if nothing happened, and we will sign a peace agreement which will involve deep Israeli land concessions. We can find ourselves in 1 year from now Palestinian president may be Ismail Haniyeh or Khalid Mashal, the leader of Hamas. And I think this is a very, very difficult juncture. And frankly, I don't have the answer for it. Prime Minister Netanyahu is visiting the United States later this week. He'll also be speaking to a joint session of Congress beginning next week. President Obama will, as I understand, be giving an important address regarding the Middle East. I think he will also be opening the APEC conference. We will see where leadership will take us, but I would be not truthful if I didn't tell you that we're at a very, very difficult moment in Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking. Thank you very much for your attention.
Our thanks to Akiva Tor for his comments this afternoon. We have lots and lots of questions from the audience, all very good ones. Thank you. So we'll get started. I want to continue a little bit talking about the Arab Spring. You touched on Egypt and you touched on some other countries, but overall there are several neighboring countries to you that are bubbling up with some uprising, and obviously we don't know which direction anything will go in, but do you see this as a collective threat? What sort of preparations are you making? How are you responding to what's going on around you at this stage of the game?
No, we do not see it as a collective threat. I think this is one of the times where Israel really has to look at its essential national interests in terms of our defense and everything else. It's really not our business. And that's been our attitude towards things going on in the Persian Gulf, things going on in Libya. We've not voiced an opinion one way or another, and I don't believe that we will. The things that are happening, we understand where they're coming from. It has to do with decades of very poor governance in numerous Arab states, of a young population which is deeply frustrated and which has achieved education, but there are no employment opportunities. A crisis which has been a part of Arab culture for a long time now and coming. It's not new. It's enough to read The Arab Predicament, which was written a long time ago by Fuad Ajami about the situation of Arab societies. And we wish all of these societies well. We would like to live in a thriving Middle East surrounded by Arab states which are reaching their full potential.
To you, what would a thriving Middle East with Arab states reaching their full potential look like?
In theory, all of them would be Jeffersonian democracies.
Very nice. Another audience member asked specifically about...
But that's not our decision. if they want to have an enlightened monarchy, that's not our decision.
Another audience member asks specifically about your defense policy. Are you doing any alterations or different plans given the situations going around, or just waiting and seeing?
I don't think... First of all, if there are operational plans, I'm not necessarily privy to them, and it wouldn't be wise to reveal them. But I think...
Oh, no, tell us.
But my general feeling is no. I don't think that we're moving towards some fundamentally new defense posture. If things will change radically, if there will be a breakdown in fundamental peace treaties that we have with major governments, and we'll have to think about what that means in terms of the size of our defense budget. But for the time being, I would say that we are observing carefully. I'd like to say also that within the Israeli public, there was actually a lot of interest and indeed a sharing of some of the Western enthusiasm. When we see the Facebook people in Cairo, we cannot remain apathetic. But we are also, I would say that our fundamental approach is prudence, because it's not clear that they will be in charge. So we are being prudent, but I don't think that there have been any fundamental changes in our in how we are going about conducting ourselves at this time.
Yeah, it seems most of these uprisings are very internally focused. As you say, I haven't heard anybody start having a global vision yet. They're just working on themselves.
Right.
As far as this weekend, you had, you know, on the Palestinian side, Nakbar.
Yes? That's right.
And on the Israeli side, the celebration of the creation of the State of Israel, and so two very diametrically opposed visions of the same event, which led to some some incidents on several borders. Can you talk a little bit about how Israel responded to that and how you might want to resolve that situation?
Well, I'd say, first of all, we celebrated Israel Independence Day. Indeed, it derives from the Declaration of the State of Israel on May 15th, the date after the coming into force of the UN partition resolution. But we actually celebrate on the Hebrew date, which is the fifth day of Iyar. So, and we have a lunar calendar. So we celebrated it last week on Monday night.
Okay.
Also, the Jewish day, like the Muslim day, begins in the evening because first came night and then day.
Right.
I think it's very sad that 63 years on, this is where we are. It's a deep problem for us that the Palestinians continue to view it as a catastrophe. It's time to move forward from catastrophe and to reach have two thriving states living next to each other. Regarding, however, what happened specifically, I think it was somewhat unprecedented. We had large numbers of people, hundreds of people, coming over border fences from states that are hostile, the Syrian border. Syrian border, I've been on the Syrian border for months and months and months and months, and no one ever comes near the gate. The Syrian army would never allow that. And all of a sudden we had, I think hundreds of Palestinians coming through a cut in the fence and to Majd al-Shams. Our policy will be one of restraint. We have no desire to shoot people who are unarmed. Where there was the greatest loss of life was on the Lebanese border, and I think that there is a. It's not 100% clear who shot who. Shots were fired. We don't know exactly what the Lebanese army did, what our own army did. In any case, I think our policy is going to be one of maximum restraint and trying not to shoot anyone who doesn't have a weapon. But indeed, there was loss of life on Sunday.
I'd like to follow up. You've talked a lot during your talk and then now about using restraint and waiting and seeing. Did any of this come from the incident last year with the aid flotilla? There was a lot of international criticism for how that went down. Did that cause Israel to stop and sort of retake a look, or is this something that Israel has always believed about restraint?
Well, I think you'll see that the Nakba events took place in several places. So they took place also within the Palestinian territories and at the Qalandia checkpoint. There was no loss of life because we're used to problems there. Where there was loss of life are situations that were not foreseen and where people were all of a sudden coming over electric fences and security barriers where Hezbollah is right on the other side. I don't think that the flotilla incident of last year is... we would be foolish not to learn from it. That's number one. But I don't think that that is where the Israel doctrine of use of force or not use of force comes from. It's much, much, much further back. And we really, lethal force is to be used against a lethal threat and not against a non-lethal threat.
You said something earlier that I found very interesting. I think a lot of people in this room share it, whatever side you're on, that 63 years on, we're still in this position. So, and you also mentioned in your talk that, you know, you and Palestinian leaders come together, talks start, all of a sudden they stop pretty quickly over precondition this, precondition that. And so what can Israel do? What can it, to approach the situation honestly and sincerely and help get over that bump to really move this process forward?
So this is really a very, the standard Israeli diplomat, we'll blame the other side, of course. But since we want to have a constructive conversation, I'd like to give a more analytical response. Tom Friedman wrote a piece, or actually I heard him speak at Stanford last week. And he said, Israel has to find a way to get itself out, to take itself out of the story. We have this story of Arab liberation in all kinds of societies. By the way, his position and the U.S. position is moving closer to the Israeli analysis under the pressure of events. But he said, Israel has to find a way to take itself out of this story. And his view was that can be done by withdrawal from the West Bank and establishment of a Palestinian state. But I think, but then he was asked by the audience, but what is the meaning of Hamas entering into Palestinian governance formally at this time? And we don't have an answer. In other words, we have to turn over every stone and look for every way to reach a peace agreement with the Palestinians. On the other hand, we cannot have a peace agreement which will enable an Israeli jetliner to be shot down by a shoulder-held missile. First of all, if that will happen, we'll have to reinvade. I mean, we're not going to commit suicide. So I agree with the premise of your question, and I think the answer is more difficult at this time. The Palestinian Unity Pact, from the standpoint of the peace treaty or the peace process, is a step backward.
Can you talk a little bit about some specific reasons why that is a step backward? I mean, you've touched on it a little bit, just to get it.
Well, look, the Hamas leaders gave there were several lectures on Nakba Day. There was the lecture of there was the public address of Abu Mazen, the Palestinian Authority president. And he spoke about how Israel is using the Unity Agreement to elude peace with the Palestinians. But there was also the lecture given by Ismail Haniyeh, and who is the leader of the Hamas movement in Gaza, and he's considered to be the more moderate figure. And he said, the meaning of the Nakba is that we will bring the Zionist enterprise. I know the Hebrew translation of the Arabic term, I don't know exactly, to an end. And that the Palestinian state will be established in Tel Aviv, or he probably said, didn't say Tel Aviv, he said Jerusalem, Haifa, Jaffa, and through all of the areas taken away from us in 1948.
So you're saying...
So what can we do with that? We want to make peace with the Palestinian people. It is rational. I think that it is the rational place for us to be, two states alongside each other. But if we have one party in the Palestinian governance which does not accept these rules whatsoever and states so clearly and emphatically and unambiguously, it doesn't leave us a lot of room. I think things will still develop, and I hope we will be able to move forward, but I'm not sure. Right now, I think we're at the moment where jaws have dropped, and it's unclear, really, what is the next step.
So you're waiting for the Hamas-Fatah agreement to yield a little bit more clarity before you can say.
Well, it's never good to be waiting too much. But I think that we are at a moment of crisis, and it's unclear exactly how we turn the corner.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We're talking with Akiva Tor, Consul General of Israel for the Pacific Northwest, about Israeli national relations. I'm Gina Bellaria. So I want to talk a little bit about, so much to talk about. We have some great questions here. The King of Jordan, he's coming to the U.S. this week, and somebody from the audience is interested in, you know, because his country is one of those facing protests, although not as vehement as some of the other countries. What would you like the King of Jordan to say? They've been an ally. They've been supportive. What would you like to hear?
Well, this goes back to our this goes back to the principle of not saying things which are counterproductive. Jordan is an important ally of Israel and a good neighbor, and we wish them well.
Okay, fair enough. Another audience member has a question about the U.S. Constitution. It's provided a framework for here in the U.S. for more than 200 years. Israel doesn't have such a constitution. Do you feel it's time maybe to create one? What are the obstacles to that? Would this help solidify?
Well, it's an interesting question. Israel does not have a constitution, but we have laws of constitutional stature. The Israel's Declaration of Independence became the basis for the basic laws. The basic laws are kind of like our Bill of Rights, which are laws which are have greater standing than any other law. They're laws of freedom of religion, basic human rights, freedom of employment, freedom of assembly, all of the standard rights have been ensconced in basic laws which are enforced by the Israeli Supreme Court. The reason that there have been many attempts to move forward from the Israel Declaration of Independence to the writing of a formal constitution. And it's been done at several levels. It's been done within the Knesset. There's a committee which has prepared a constitution about this size. There's the Israel Democracy Institute, which wrote the Platonic constitution, which the academics agreed to, but it would be very difficult for it to pass in the Knesset. In other words, the ideal constitution. We're not there yet. Some of the reasons are that a constitution will require us to make certain definitions regarding the exact place of religion in society. And the United States had its issues. You wrote a constitution, but you had a civil war 60 years later. I think that we're not at the place to write the constitution at this time. However, the Israel Declaration of Independence was a unique document. It was a document which was signed by all of the political parties in the Knesset, which included Agudat Yisrael, which was an ultra-religious party, which was only nominally pro-Zionist, as well as the Israeli Communist Party, which didn't believe in God. So how will the deity be mentioned in the event of greatest historical significance in the last 2,000 years for the Jewish people? And David Ben-Gurion and the writers of the Declaration of Independence had very, very great wisdom. They wrote, with faith in the Rock of Israel. So what is Rock of Israel? Rock of Israel could be the creator of the world, and it could also be Jewish history. So the document itself has provided us many of the resources that we require in order to move forward. The most important one is the Israel Declaration of Independence kind of defines Israel as a Jewish and democratic state. It did that by one paragraph saying that Israel is the nation state of the Jewish people and will be faithful to the moral doctrine of the prophets of Israel. So this is the definition of Israel as fundamentally the nation-state of the Jewish people and also in some ways in tune with the cultural values of Jewish culture, generally speaking. But it also said that Israel will guarantee the rights of all minorities within us, seeks to make peace with all our neighbors, and will live and will be faithful to the Charter of the United Nations. And Israel Supreme Court has been able to use this document as a basis for strengthening all the time, on the one hand, to find the balance between Israel's Jewishness and its democratic nature. So we do need a constitution, but it's not essential for our operations at this exact moment.
Okay, thank you very much. I want to talk a little bit about the recent announcement of George Mitchell. He has been working with Middle East Peace and just announced that he plans to retire. How did Israel greet that news?
I think he resigned, actually.
Resigned. Oh, I thought he retired. Resigns. Forgive me.
Well, we feel bad that Senator Mitchell didn't succeed.
Is there any you know, anything further? How was it working with him from Israel's perspective? And what do you think is lost there? And what do you hope can be brought with someone new entering the process?
Again, I'm sorry to come back to it, but we're at a crisis moment. If Hamas is formally a part of the Palestinian government with whom we are asked to negotiate an agreement, we will have a real problem moving forward unless they change their fundamental position towards us. We're not asking them to accept this boundary or that boundary or this position regarding anything. But they do have to meet the quartet requirements. They have to accept that we have a right to be there. Otherwise, we're simply entering into a negotiation for how to weaken our strategic position against an enemy government, and that we're not going to do. So I don't think it's the issue so much as right now the personality that will take George Mitchell's place. It's what are we going to do about this situation? I do think it's really very important for the international community to say very, very clearly to the Palestinians that you want to be united. Well, you're going to have to find a way to do it which works within the international system and which works also regarding your obligations towards your immediate neighbor.
I'd like to move on now to Netanyahu's visit later this week with President Obama. President Obama has not been so, I mean, he's been supportive, but maybe not so unilaterally supportive, say, as past presidents. And I'm wondering, what does Netanyahu hope to get from this meeting? And what challenges do the two leaders face when it comes to sort of unifying their vision?
I think, first of all, I don't know what will be said at the meeting, and I'm not privy to the Prime Minister's speech before Congress and how everything the Prime Minister will say. But one thing I'm pretty sure about, I think that the Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama agree deeply regarding the Iranian issue. On this, they agree, and I think that there will be an attempt to figure out what that agreement means. What does it imply? Because so far, UN Security Council has passed three rounds of sanctions, and it hasn't stopped the Iranian effort. So the question is, what next? And actually, a lot can be done, I think. They will certainly speak about what all this means, and I hope that they will have an agreement about how it's necessary to speak to the Palestinians regarding how to move forward.
You talked about Iran and the nuclear program in your talk as well, and we have a few questions from the audience who are quite interested in hearing a little bit more about that. And I wanted to touch a little bit on, you had mentioned in your talk about oil, and people are still buying oil from Iran, and that sort of helped, that sort of puts a damper on sanctions. Unfortunately, so many countries are dependent on oil. It's a necessity, and that's where they're getting it. So, is Israel doing anything? First of all, is Israel doing anything to decrease dependence on oil? And is there any way Israel can help encourage other countries to do the same? I guess that's my first question.
So, look, we're a country of, we're only 7.8 million people, and I think that we're quite successful economically, and we have a big presence here in Northern California, but. We can't change the nature of the world economy. We can only try to lead a little bit by example. So we indeed celebrated Israel's Independence Day at the Legion of Honor this year, and we had two exhibits. The theme of the gathering was from past to present. The past was a mosaic which is on loan from the Israel Antiquities Authority in the Diyung, in the Legion of the Honor. It's from a Roman villa in Lod, Israel. It's very beautiful, and I recommend going to see it. It's remarkably preserved. And the second thing that we had was at the entrance to the Legion of Honor, we had an electric car. It's from the company Better Place, which is an American company with a lot of Israeli leadership. Israel will be the first country in the third quarter of 2011 to have a national electric car grid. What that means is that it will be possible in an electric battery-operated car to drive straight from the northernmost tip of Israel, Metula, to our southernmost tip in Eilat, either through the West Bank or around the West Bank, one way or the other, but you'll be able to do it without having to stop. In other words, you'll be able to pull into battery swapping stations and change. You'll be able to drive throughout the country with an electric car. So, by the way, that's still the question, is how that electricity will be produced. And, well, it can be produced by natural gas or by oil or by coal or by nuclear or perhaps even by solar. But in any case, that's a direction. That's our contribution. Having said that, there are a lot of countries that produce oil, and it's not essential to use Iranian oil. There are replacements for Iranian oil.
Okay. Speaking of replacements, one audience member asks, what's the status of the recently discovered oil off the coast of Israel?
It's actually natural gas. We found natural gas within our territorial waters in the Mediterranean. I think that we will be able to use this gas within 2 to 3 years. It will meet our domestic needs, and perhaps will also enable Israel some export capacity. My hope is that it doesn't ruin us. And so far, the Israeli economy has been based on lack of natural resources. The only natural resource we really have is sun in the Negev Desert and certain minerals in the Dead Sea, which are good for cosmetics and potash and this and that, but you can't burn them or create fuel. That's really forced us. We don't have metals. We haven't had large amounts of fossil fuel, and that's forced us to develop an economy which is based on a knowledge-based economy. And that's very much fueled Israel's high-tech abilities. So now we've got the natural gas, and I hope that we don't become fat and lazy. I trust that we won't.
I trust you won't. You mentioned nuclear a little earlier, and I would ask you about it anyway, but of course, given the recent catastrophe in Japan, I'm wondering, has Israel been considering a move to nuclear energy, and is that still on the table?
It's been thought about, but it hasn't been pursued seriously.
Okay, great.
And we're, by the way, we're also on a major fault line. We're on the Syro-African fault, and one of the jobs of our consulate, by the way, has been learning from California how to prepare for earthquake, because we're scheduled for a big one.
Israel, too. Israel's scheduled for
a... We're scheduled for, well, between now and 100 years from now.
Yes, same with, yes, that's California. We're waiting. So I would like to go back to Iran a little bit. And again, I know you talked about it, but I'm wondering, given the political and economic and natural resource realities, it's true there are other options for oil than Iran, but it does indeed have a large reserve. What can be done? What can be done at
well,
this point?
Well, maybe we should talk about the state of California.
Sure.
Okay. So California actually is... Despite all of your issues in Sacramento and everything that Governor Brown is trying to do in order to heal your budget and your governance, and I met him recently, and he's completely determined, and everyone wishes him all the best. But he points out in all the conversations, by the way, that California is actually quite a wealthy state, and the problems that you have are not as large as you think. They can be solved. But California is also the world's seventh, maybe eighth, but probably seventh largest economy. And California on its own can actually do a lot to isolate Iran economically. California passed a law in 2007 called the California Divest from Iran Act. And that required, under federal law, it's already U.S. companies are not allowed to be invested in the Iranian energy sector. But it's possible to invest in foreign companies that are invested. So this law required CalPERS and CalSTRS to pull their money out of those companies. And unfortunately, the compliance has not been that great. That's number one. Number two is the former insurance commissioner, Steve Poizner, wanted to get the California insurance industry to pull its investments out of Iran. Frankly, that's huge. The insurance industry's investments are... over $4 trillion. It's like the largest investments of anyone. If that will follow through, if that can be nailed down with the law in the California legislature, that would be incredible. It would take the entire insurance industry out of Gazprom and out of the Chinese companies that are developing the Iranian energy sector. Iranian energy is not easy to pump, by the way. It's not very desirable oil. It requires a lot of technology. And if it's not economical because California won't insure with companies that are invested there, it will force the Iranian government to think twice about the production of nuclear weapons.
Thank you very much. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. We are talking with Consul General from Israel, Akiva Tor, about Israeli international relations and the various parts of that. I'm Gina Valeria. I have a question here from the audience. It sort of gets to a bigger picture. The political territorial dispute between Israelis and the greater Muslim world is just the top layer. The basis is the ideological religious level. Does Israel have any disposition for that debate? And I guess to talk a little bit about, I mean, I guess you can take, I'm not sure you can take that question however you like.
Well, I think the questioner is that's a pessimistic view. I mean, there is a view that that the Arab world fundamentally does not accept the presence of a non-Arab presence in the Middle East, and will reject it, and any agreements which are signed are only temporary, and they won't hold up. We don't agree with that. There are indeed states that feel that way. There are indeed political parties. The state of Iran, which is not an Arab state, feels that way. But by the way, they didn't always feel that way. There was a time when El Al flew to Tehran before the Islamic Revolution, and we don't have actually any reason to have an argument with Iran. We think that it is possible to make peace with the Arab Middle East. And we also believe that these forces that are trying to take the Middle East towards progress will ultimately, in time, come together if they go on a right track and if they don't take the Arab world in a very, very fundamentalist direction. It will take it. I mean, modernizing states which want to do well by their people will make peace with Israel. It's our mutual interest.
Thank you very much.
So I don't share the pessimism of the questioner.
Okay, great. Thank you. There's another question from an audience member specifically asking about the well pipes under the West Bank. And their question, their premise is that Israel is taking water from the West Bank. And can you address that a little bit?
Well, we're taking water from each other because we share two aquifers. So there's the northern aquifer and the southern aquifer, both run under the West Bank and Israel, and they reach to the Mediterranean Ocean. So we are both pumping from the same aquifer, and we need that water for our populations. And one of the most important topics within the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians is how to share water. And I think that we are abiding by all agreements with the Palestinians. One of the reasons why peace is so important is because however fairly we divide the water resources, there's not enough. We actually have to produce water. And that will require very, very large-scale desalination. Israel has begun in that direction. We're now moving towards a quarter of our drinking water is desalinated currently. We're going to move towards larger numbers. We're also, almost all of our agricultural irrigation is from recycled water. I think when the day comes and Israel and the Palestinians indeed make peace, one of the first things we're going to have to do is figure out where we build the joint desalination plants and how we fund them and how we share the waters of the Mediterranean desalted between us.
Thank you very much. So we have just a few minutes left, and I have several questions I'm going to go through here. Thank you, everybody, again, for all the great questions you've turned in. Let's turn to Osama bin Laden, you know, somebody who is not a bordering nation. We all know what happened. And one audience member would like to know, how does that help or hinder or impact at all the peace process in the Middle East? And what impact might this have on Israel, if any?
Well, we, like everyone else, we were absolutely horrified by what happened in New York City on 9/11, and we're happy that justice has been done. How it will affect things is unclear.
Thank you. There's also an audience member who's curious about what might happen with Mr. Gaddafi in Libya. You've addressed this a little earlier, but I thought I'd ask you directly.
It's not our issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that they're a little farther. Are you involved at all with NATO or with any? No,
we're not a NATO member.
No, okay.
We cooperate with NATO, but not in this operation.
Okay.
Nor have we been asked to.
Okay. One audience member wants to know, how can Jerusalem reinvent itself so young secular Israelis feel welcome there? Maybe feeling that they didn't find a place there when they visited.
Well, actually, the current mayor of Jerusalem is very much devoted to that, and he's also very much devoted to the unity of Jerusalem, for Jerusalem being a modern city for everyone. He's run into quite a lot of difficulties, including some tensions with the American administration. For example, when he wants to modernize an Arab neighborhood, his positions are not always accepted. Jerusalem is our capital city, and it suffers from some problems of capital cities. First of all, we have a lot of government employees who don't make so much money. And in addition to that, we have in Jerusalem two sectors, which are the poorest sectors in Israel. On the one hand, ultra-Orthodox, who only one member of the family is working, the wife. On the other hand, Arab Israelis or Palestinians living in Jerusalem, who also only one member of the family is working, the husband. So we have large populations who are not wealthy, and it's not very good for the city. So we have to work very hard to make this city thriving and attractive for secular young people so that they will build their homes there and raise their families there. We also have a problem that Jerusalem is small and there is not a lot of land and everything is quite political. It's not easy to do things. It's not easy to act on behalf of the city. Our view is that Jerusalem will do best as a city united under Israeli sovereignty, where we have to figure out exactly how we will recognize the rights of all of the either Israeli Arabs or Palestinians who are living within Jerusalem. But that a lot of that is coming from our sense that the city will do best if it's united. But that's not accepted on the Palestinian side. Despite all of that, we have to make Jerusalem really do well. Yesterday, I was lucky enough to see a presentation of the new Israel Museum, which is in Jerusalem. It's incredible. And it's a good example of how a world-class institution of really incredible and one which is devoted to coexistence, by the way, is thriving in our capital city, despite everything.
So I'm down to my last question now, and I'd like to ask you, you have dedicated your life to international relations on behalf of Israel, and I want to allow you to the opportunity to talk about what you hope your efforts and your labors will achieve.
Well, I believe that my job is to try to achieve greater understanding for Israel's positions. And I think that Israel's positions are, for the most part, we're not perfect, but for the most part, and on most days, very reasonable. And I think that we're a country which is often misunderstood, and it's my job to help that understanding. In past jobs, I was involved in actual peacemaking. When we were working in the 90s, in the heyday of the peace process, and actually finding ways for Palestinian and Israeli society to meet. Unfortunately, we're not at that place right now. But that is something that I would very much hope to contribute to in the future. And in general, in public audiences, today's audience is very attentive, but I think the young people are either busy in university, but they're not in the audience. Generally, I try, whenever speaking on college campuses or before young people, to really encourage people to enter public service, especially law students. Why give your talents to the corporate world? Do something for humanity. And I think that diplomatic corps is one place where that can be done as well.
Our thanks to Akiva Tor, Consul General of Israel for the Pacific Northwest. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and internet. I'm Gina Valeria, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.